fear can make lies and simplistic thinking believable. We need courage. And if the United States had a democracy rather than bombing people in the name of democracy, I wouldn't have to convince you all of a thing. The U.S. public already favors military reductions and greater use of diplomacy. Such moves would stimulate a reverse arms race, and that would open more eyes to the possibility of advancing further in that direction, the direction of what is required by morality, what is necessary for the habitability of our planet, what we must pursue if we are to survive, the complete abolition of the institution of war.
That's David Swanson. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features David Swanson and Pete Kilner. Is war ever justifiable? In 1970, at the height of the U.S. wars in Indochina, Edwin Starr came out with his classic song, War. In it, he asks, "War, what is it good for?" And he answers, "Absolutely nothing." Well, for the giant weapons manufacturing corporations, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, General Dynamics, and all the rest, war pays off big time. They make money hand over fist, especially with their cost-plus contracts. And then there are the delays in delivery and technical problems. Whether they are F-35 fighter jets, stealth destroyers, Trident submarines, or aircraft carriers, the Pentagon gets what it wants. And taxpayers foot the bill. Policymakers in Washington always come up with rationales to engage in war. Since 2001, the United States has been continually at war, and it has greatly expanded the number of countries it is attacking. Is war ever justifiable? Our guests today are David Swanson and Pete Kilner. David Swanson is an activist, journalist, and radio host, and he's director of worldbeyondwar.org. He's the author of War is Never Just and Curing Exceptionalism. He has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Pete Kilner served more than 28 years in the Army, as an infantryman and professor. A graduate of West Point, he deployed multiple times to Iraq and Afghanistan. Swanson answers no to the question, is war ever justifiable? Kilner argues yes. They spoke at Radford University in Radford, Virginia. We begin with Pete Kilner.
I say that war can be justifiable in certain circumstances, but don't think that I am pro-war. I've had 5 of my students killed, you know, friends killed. I've seen too much of war, a lot of innocent people. War is not good, but in a certain situation, it is the right thing to do, and that's the argument I'm going to make tonight. War is a crime. Every time there's a war, there is someone who's done something really bad, usually a political leadership, who is imposing violence on some other political community. But just because it's a crime doesn't mean that no one should be involved. If someone comes up to you when you're walking home tonight and attempts to murder you, they are a criminal, you are a victim, and you have every right to fight back. If someone comes up and tries to rape you, they are a criminal, but in the name of peace, you don't have to put up with it. You can fight back. We have human rights, and the argument I'm going to make is that based on our human rights, which give rise to our communal rights, we have rights also to defend ourselves against other countries. So war is justifiable when your political community, your country, has been attacked by an aggressor nation. Let me tell you quickly about kind of how I got into this position. I grew up probably pretty much on the militarist side of things, right? So there's 3 broad groups. Militarists, who think war is kind of a good thing, a noble thing, mostly about national interests, they're not worried about ethics. Then you have pacifists, who say war is a horrible thing, we should never do it. And then you have the middle ground, which I'm arguing for, which is saying war can be justifiable if you're on the defending side. Right? So first, we do have a right that another human being not kill us. We do have a right that another human being not enslave us. Our right to free speech is the right that someone doesn't prevent us coerce us from being able to speak our minds. So these core rights we all agree with, these are negative rights. These are claims against another person that says, you can't do something to me. There are other kinds of rights, positive rights. You have the right to health care. You have the right to income. Those are much more disputed. Because now you're saying not that someone should leave you alone. You're saying someone owes you something. But our country is based on, and the notion of human rights, traditionally, on these negative rights, the right not to be killed, not to be enslaved, the right to bodily integrity. Every human being has those by virtue of being a human being. But we also know that we can forfeit our rights. There's more than 1 million Americans in jail right now because they did something that forfeited their right to live freely in society. If you're walking home and someone attacks you, you just naturally know through natural law, you have the right to fight back. You'd almost be disregarding yourself if you didn't. And it's because everyone has a right, but we can forfeit our right. And when a human being threatens another human being who still possesses their right, that threatener forfeits their own right for the time during which they're a threat. And that's why if someone comes at you, you can fight back. And that's why other passerbys can come and help save you and do violence to that person, because that person has forfeited their right not to be harmed because they're harming someone else. And we always want to think about it. The person who is creating that threat and that harm is the person during that time who forfeits their own right. Now, the other people, think about it. They don't have to stop and help you because their rights aren't being threatened. But they do it out of love for a fellow human being. Right? I think almost everything in morality can be understood by three big principles. Respect other people, respect their human dignity, support the common good, and love one another, right? Which is a more positive duty. So when those others come to help you, think how grateful you would be that through their love, they stopped you from being harmed. And I'll think about a police force. The police are people who say, we're not worried about just what comes to us, anyone attacking us or attacking our family or something we see. Our job is to try to prevent this behavior and to stop this behavior when we see it. The police protect us from threats inside of our political community. What the law, and based on morality, I think very well, says about when we can ever do harm to another person. Someone forfeits their right when they have the intent to do harm, the capability to do harm, and when the harm is imminent, right? They can't be running away saying, I'm going to come back and get you later. It would be wrong to shoot him in the back, right? And so that's why for that police officer, if that police officer puts the gun on the criminal and the criminal puts up their hands, the police officer should not shoot. That's a statement that their intent is no longer threatening. So they, of course, they say drop the weapon, right? Because then when someone doesn't have capability to do harm, they're no longer a threat and they regain their right not to be killed. We see the same thing in war at the individual level. Soldiers should never kill. As soon as an enemy soldier surrenders or an enemy soldier is wounded and incapacitated, it would be morally wrong to kill them. They're no longer a threat and they regain their right not to be killed. Now, I'm guessing that my colleague here, my pastor's colleague, is agreeing with the right not to be killed at an individual level and the police officer level, and they say war isn't like that. Because war is, think about it. I've been to war, deployed 5 times. Any just war should be, by just war theory, a war of last resort. A just war is a necessary war, but it's a war that if you cede, if you just give up, you can't do anything more. And we always have the right to fight to defend our political community. When Germany attacked Poland, 1939, the Polish had the right to fight to try to defend their political community. When Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990, the Kuwaitis had a right to fight back to defend their political community. Just like individuals have that right. So because a war is between these political communities, that's why you don't have to wait. I have to talk to soldiers about this. You don't have to be personally threatened. The war is between us and Al-Qaeda. Okay, the chance for talking about peace is gone. The fight is on. When you get the chance, you should kill the enemy combatants, as long as they're still combatants. take that back to the individual case. If someone attacks you when you're walking home tonight with a knife, and you're down on the ground and that knife is coming towards your eyeball, it would be stupid for your knee to say, well, I'm not personally threatened. I'm not going to knee him in the groin, right? No, because we're all one body, and our body has to work together. If any of us is threatened, all of us is threatened, we should all work together to end the threat. And that's how it is in war. Our political community, judged by our political leaders, they've said, we are so threatened that we have to fight. The other options aren't working. The military is the fist of the body politic. The whole rest of the body is going to suffer and die unless you fight. And that's what we do. Just like our fist does it for our own body if you get attacked tonight, the military does it for our own political community. Now, I wish the proper role in this political body is for the head to be very deliberative. And the head is our political leadership. And they should be trying to find any other way to fight. Right? In the military, our role is to win the war if our political leadership, elected by all of us, says that that's what we have to do. The thing that's missing right now, I think, within our polity is the civilian leadership and the civilian people understanding when war is just and saying we're only going to go to war when war is just. But still, I mean, I have the easy role in this argument. All I have to say is, can war be justifiable? Of course. When you are attacked, to defend yourself is justifiable. That can be a mental leap for us because no one's going to attack the United States anytime soon. We're pretty big, we're powerful, and we're protected by oceans. But I guarantee you that if United States forces were not physically present and willing to fight to defend Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, probably even Poland, Western Ukraine, Georgia, the parts that Russia hasn't already invaded, Russia would be using force to take those over. And sometimes it doesn't make sense to us. Like, why would they do that? Why don't we all just get along? There's always a minority of people throughout history, in all times, in all places, in all cultures, who won't just get along, who will violate the rights of others, violate the property rights. I've been in Iraq where there was lawlessness in 2003 when the government fell. And hey, this is your chance to all get along. This horrible dictator that was so bad to you is gone. And what did people do? They were just killing each other, right? It was massive theft. Why? Because some human beings will do bad things. And that's at the individual level, that's at the societal level, that's at the international level. And as long as you have evil in the world, you have to have some people who are willing to fight to defend against that evil.
What we just heard was mostly theoretical about unnamed wars. I would have expected a long list of examples of the wars that have been justifiable. We heard Poland and we heard the Gulf War. Last resorts, nothing else could have been done. They were just and humane and good wars. Iraq, before the Gulf War, was willing to negotiate a peaceful settlement. It proposed that Israel also withdraw from the Palestinian territories while Iraq withdrew from Kuwait. It proposed a weapons of mass destruction free zone for the Middle East. And many governments of the world encouraged pursuing those negotiations. The United States' preference was for war. There is no such thing as war as a last resort. There is going out of your way to avoid peace. And as if we can talk about actual examples of wars, I would love to hear some examples of the ones that have been justified and of the ones that haven't been justified. And I would love to know how you quantify the difference, how you determine the good that's supposedly accomplished and how many deaths are justified by that good. I would like to know how to quantify that. Pete wrote in the Washington Post in 2006 that people were blind to all the good that U.S. soldiers were doing and the war was doing for Iraq, a nation absolutely destroyed by that war. I want to know what that good was. Regardless of whether the good outweighed the bad and the war was justified or not, I'd like to know that too. But what in the world was that good? The idea that wars are somehow self-defense and that this justifies wars, I mean, that argument has to go both ways. Both sides can claim it. But if only one side gets to claim it, well, it's not this one. It's Iraq. It's Afghanistan. It's Vietnam. It's the places attacked that can more plausibly make that claim. But it doesn't justify making war. And justifying a soldier's actions within a war doesn't justify the decision to initiate a war. And a soldier is not a civilian with the right to self-defense, you know, a right that does not come because somebody else has forfeited their right. It comes most plausibly because it's actually a last resort, because they have tried nonviolent approaches, which in an individual case can run out. It's not a good analogy to a war, because the same does not apply. In war, most of the killing historically has happened while the other soldiers are retreating, including killing some 30,000 Iraqis in that good war, in that justifiable war, the Gulf War. Following an illegal order is not legal. An Iraqi village is not a threat to a drone pilot, and Iraq was never a threat to the United States. These are not facts.
I'll try to answer all your questions. Some just wars, World War II, the I-4 intervention in Bosnia. If you're not familiar with Srebrenica, look it up. When UN troops were not willing to fight, 9,000 men got slaughtered. When the United States came in, the slaughter ended. We waited 5 years and 300,000 people had to die before we ended the slaughter by going in there with military force, and the people will be forever grateful to us there in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Afghanistan, OIF-1. You know, all they had to do was turn over al-Qaeda. They decided to put in their bit with them, a foreign government that sponsors people who have declared war on you and are killing your citizens has forfeited its right as a government, not the people. Bad wars, Grenada, bad war, Panama, bad war. 80s, I guess, wasn't a good decade.
So everything I say in this quick overview is going to raise more questions than it answers. Let's begin with the fact that war is optional. It is not dictated to us by genes or outside forces. To the extent that people mostly shouting at each other and waving sticks and swords can be called the same thing as a person sitting at a desk with a joystick sending missiles into villages halfway around the world, this thing called war has been far more absent than present in human existence. Many societies have done without it. The notion that war is natural is frankly ridiculous. A great deal of conditioning is needed to prepare most people to take part in war, and a great deal of mental suffering, including higher suicide rates, is common among those who have taken part. In contrast, not a single person is known to have suffered deep moral regret or post-traumatic stress disorder from war deprivation. War does not correlate with population density or resource shortages. It is quite simply most used by those societies most accepting of it. The United States is high on and in some ways dominates the top of that list. Surveys have found the U.S. public among wealthy nations the most supportive of, quote, preemptively attacking other countries. Polls have also found that in the U.S., 44% of people claim they would fight in a war for their country, while in many other countries with equal or higher standard of living, that response is under 20%. U.S. culture is saturated with militarism, and the U.S. government is uniquely devoted to it, spending almost the same as the rest of the world combined, despite most of the other big spenders being close allies whom the U.S. pushes to spend more. In fact, every other nation on Earth spends closer to the $0 spent by Costa Rica or Iceland than to the $1 trillion spent by the United States. The U.S. maintains some 800 bases in other people's countries, while all other nations on Earth combined maintain a few dozen foreign bases. Since World War II, the U.S. has killed or helped kill some 20 million people, overthrown at least 36 governments, interfered in at least 84 foreign elections, attempted to assassinate over 50 foreign leaders, dropped bombs on people in over 30 countries. For the past 16 years, the U.S. has been systematically damaging a region of the globe, bombing Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Libya, Somalia, Yemen, and Syria. The U.S. has so-called special forces in two-thirds of the countries on Earth. When I watch a basketball game on TV, the announcers will thank the U.S. troops for watching from 175 countries. That's uniquely American. In 2016, a presidential primary debate question was, would you be willing to kill hundreds and thousands of innocent children? That doesn't happen in election debates in other countries where the other 96% of humanity lives. U.S. foreign policy journals discuss whether to attack North Korea or Iran. That's uniquely American. The publics of most countries polled in 2013 by Gallup called the U.S. the greatest threat to peace in the world. Pew found that viewpoint increased in 2017. So this country has an unusually strong investment in war, though it is far from the only war maker. But what would it take to have a justifiable war? According to just war theory, a war must meet several criteria, which I find fall into these three categories: the non-empirical, the amoral, and the impossible. By non-empirical, I mean things like right intention, a just cause, and proportionality. When your government says that blowing up a building where ISIS has stored money justifies killing up to 50 people, there is no agreed-upon empirical test to go out there and reply, no, it's only 49, or it's 6, or it's 4,097 people can be justly killed. Attaching some just cause to a war, such as ending slavery, never explains all the actual causes of a war and does nothing to justify the war. During a time when much of the globe ended slavery and serfdom without a war, claiming that as the cause for a war carries no weight. By amoral criteria, I mean things like being publicly declared and being waged by legitimate and competent authorities. These are not moral concerns. Even in a world where we actually had competent and legitimate authorities, they wouldn't make a war any more or less just. Does anyone really picture a family in Yemen hiding from a constantly buzzing drone being thankful that it's been sent to them by a competent and legitimate authority? By impossible, I mean things like be a last resort, have a reasonable prospect of success, keep non-combatants immune from attack, respect enemy soldiers as human beings, treat prisoners of war as non-combatants. To call something a last resort is in reality merely to claim it is the best idea you have, not the only idea you have. There are always other ideas that anyone can think of, even if you're in the role of the Afghans or the Iraqis actually being attacked. Studies like those of Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan have found nonviolent resistance to domestic and even foreign tyranny to be twice as likely to succeed, and those successes to be far longer lasting. We can look to successes, some partial, some complete, against foreign invasions over the years, Nazi-occupied Denmark and Norway, in India, in Palestine, Western Sahara, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Ukraine, etc., and many dozens of successes against regimes that in many cases have had foreign support. My hope is that the more that people learn the tools of nonviolence and their power, the more they will believe in and choose to make use of that power, which will increase the power of nonviolence in a virtuous cycle. But continuing with the impossible criteria, what about respecting a person while trying to kill her or him? There are lots of ways to respect a person, but none of them exist simultaneously with trying to kill that person. In fact, I would rank right at the bottom of people who respect me, people who are trying to kill me. Remember, just war theory was created by people who believed that killing someone was doing them a favor. And non-combatants are the majority of casualties in modern wars, overwhelmingly, so they cannot be kept safe. And there is no reasonable prospect of success available. The U.S. military is on an enormous, record-breaking losing streak. But the biggest reason that no war can ever be justified is not that no war can ever meet all the criteria of just war theory, but rather that war is not an incident. It is an institution. Many people in the U.S. will concede that many U.S. wars have been unjust, but claim justness for World War II or Bosnia or a couple others. Others claim no just wars yet, but join the masses in supposing that there might be a justifiable war someday. It is that supposition, far more than any wars, that kill people. The U.S. government spends over $1 trillion on war and war preparations each year, while 3% of that could end starvation, and 1% of it end the lack of clean drinking water globally. The military budget is the only place with the resources needed to try to save the Earth's climate. Far more lives are lost and damaged through the failure to spend money well than through the violence of war. And more are lost or put at risk through side effects of that violence than directly. War and war preparations are the biggest destroyer of the natural environment. Most countries on Earth burn less fossil fuels than does the U.S. military. Most Superfund disaster sites, even in this country, are at military bases. The institution of war is the biggest eroder of our liberties, even when the wars are marketed under the word freedom. This institution impoverishes us, threatens the rule of law, degrades our culture by fueling violence, bigotry, the militarization of police and mass surveillance. This institution puts us all at risk of nuclear disaster, and it endangers rather than protects those societies that engage in it. According to the Washington Post, President Trump asked Secretary of so-called Defense James Mattis why he should send troops to Afghanistan, and Mattis said, to prevent a bomb in Times Square. Yet the man who tried to set off a bomb in Times Square 7 years ago said it was to get the U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. For North Korea to try to occupy the United States would require a force many times larger than the North Korean military. For North Korea to attack the United States, were it actually capable, would be suicide. Could it happen? Well, look at what the CIA said before the U.S. attacked Iraq. Iraq would be most likely to use its weapons only if attacked. Apart from the non-existence of those weapons, that was accurate. Terrorism has predictably increased during the war on terrorism, as measured by the Global Terrorism Index. 99.5% of terrorist attacks occur in countries engaged in wars and/or abuses such as imprisonment without trial, torture, or lawless killing. The highest rates of terrorism are in so-called liberated and democratized Iraq and Afghanistan. The terrorist groups responsible for the most terrorism, that is, non-state politically motivated violence around the world, have grown out of U.S. wars against terrorism. Those wars themselves have caused numerous just retired top U.S. government officials and a few U.S. government reports to describe military violence as counterproductive, as creating more enemies than are killed. 95% of all suicide terrorist attacks are conducted to encourage foreign occupiers to get out of the terrorist's home country. And an FBI study in 2012 said that anger over U.S. military operations abroad was the most commonly cited motivation for individuals involved in cases of so-called homegrown terrorism in the U.S. These facts lead me to three conclusions. One, foreign terrorism in the United States could be virtually eliminated by keeping the U.S. military out of any country that is not the United States. Two, if Canada wanted anti-Canadian terrorist networks on a U.S. scale or just wanted to get threatened by North Korea, it would need to radically increase its bombings, occupying, and base construction around the world. Three, on the model of the war on terrorism, the war on drugs that produces more drugs, the war on poverty that seems to increase poverty, we would be wise to consider launching a war on sustainable prosperity and happiness.
You're listening to David Swanson and Pete Kilner. Is war ever justifiable? This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
For a war on North Korea to be justifiable, for example, the U.S. would have to have not gone to such efforts over the years to avoid peace and provoke conflict. It would have to be innocently attacked. It would have to lose the ability to think so that no alternatives could be considered. It would have to redefine success to include a scenario in which a nuclear winter might cause much of the earth to lose the ability to grow crops or eat. By the way, Keith Payne, a drafter of the new Nuclear Posture Review back in 1980, parodying Dr. Strangelove, defined success to allow 20 million Americans dead and unlimited non-Americans dead. It would also have to invent bombs that spare non-combatants. It would have to devise a means of respecting people while killing them. And in addition, this remarkable war would have to do so much good as to outweigh all the damage done by decades of preparing for such a war, all the economic damage, political damage, damage to the Earth's land, water, and climate, all the deaths by starvation and disease that could have been so easily spared, plus all the horrors of all the unjust wars that were facilitated by the preparations for the dreamed-of just war, plus the risk of nuclear apocalypse created by the institution of war. No war can meet such standards. so-called humanitarian wars, which is what Hitler called his invasion of Poland and NATO called its invasion of Libya, do not, of course, measure up to just war theory, but neither do they benefit humanity. What the U.S. and Saudi militaries are doing to Yemen is the worst humanitarian disaster in years. The U.S. sells or gives weapons to 73% of the world's dictators and gives military training to many of them. Studies have found that there is no correlation between the severity of human rights abuses in a country and the likelihood of Western invasion of that country. But other studies have found that oil importing countries are 100 times more likely to intervene in civil wars of oil exporting countries. And in fact, the more oil a country produces or owns, the higher the likelihood of third party interventions. The U.S., like any other war maker, has to work hard to avoid peace. The U.S. has spent years rejecting out-of-hand peace negotiations for Syria. In 2011, so that NATO could begin bombing Libya, the African Union was prevented by NATO from presenting a peace plan to Libya. In 2003, Iraq was open to unlimited inspections or even the departure of its president, according to numerous sources, including the president of Spain, to whom U.S. President Bush recounted Hussein's offer to leave. In 2001, Afghanistan was open to turning Osama bin Laden over to a third country for trial. In 1999, the U.S. State Department deliberately set the bar too high, according to members of the U.S. State Department, insisting on NATO's right to occupy all of Yugoslavia so that Serbia wouldn't agree and would therefore supposedly need to be bombed. Go back through history. The United States sabotaged peace proposals for Vietnam. The Soviet Union proposed peace negotiations before the Korean War. Spain wanted the sinking of the USS Maine to go to international arbitration before the Spanish-American War. Mexico was willing to negotiate the sale of its northern half. In each case, the US preferred war. Peace would not seem so difficult if people stopped going to such efforts to avoid it, like Mike Pence in a room with a woman from North Korea trying not to indicate awareness of her presence. And if we stopped letting them scare us. Fear can make lies and simplistic thinking believable. We need courage. We need to lose this fantasy of total safety that drives us to create ever greater danger. And if the United States had a democracy rather than bombing people in the name of democracy, I wouldn't have to convince you all of a thing. The U.S. public already favors military reductions and greater use of diplomacy. Such moves would stimulate a reverse arms race, and that would open more eyes to the possibility of advancing further in that direction, the direction of what is required by morality, what is necessary for the habitability of our planet, what we must pursue if we are to survive, the complete abolition of the institution of war. One more point. When I say that war can never be justified, I'm willing to agree to disagree about wars in the past if we can agree on wars in the future. That is, if you think that before nuclear weapons, before the end of legal conquest, before the general end of colonialism, and before the growth in understanding of the powers of nonviolence, some war like World War II was justified, I disagree, and I'll tell you why at length, but let's agree that we now live in a different world in which Hitler does not live and in which we must abolish war if our species is to continue. Of course, if you want to travel back in time to World War II, why not travel back to World War I, the disastrous conclusion of which had smart observers predicting World War II on the spot? Why not travel back to the West's support for Nazi Germany in the 30s? We can look honestly at a war in which the U.S. was not threatened and about which the U.S. president had to lie to gain support, a war that killed several times the number of people in the war as were killed in the Nazis' camps, a war that followed the West's refusal to accept the Jews whom Hitler wanted to expel, a war that was entered through provocation of the Japanese, not innocent surprise. We can learn history instead of mythology, but let's recognize that we can choose to do better than our history going forward. So when my colleague tells us that a war is only justified, this was his opening remarks, a war is justifiable when your country has been attacked by an aggressor nation. This does not describe any wars I'm aware of. It certainly does not describe the Gulf War. Who attacked the United States to start the Gulf War? Who attacked the United States to start the war on Bosnia? This is a mythology that somehow having U.S. troops abroad being attacked, or having our economic interest. This was Trump's State of the Union. He justified more military spending, more nuclear weapons, because nations might challenge our values or our economic interests. Are you going to threaten genocide for a better trade agreement? What do you mean, threaten your values? You mean not share them? I'd be glad if people didn't share Mr. Trump's values in many cases, I'm sorry to say. So I would love to hear from my colleagues some examples of when the United States was attacked by an aggressor nation and why we need to dump our grandchildren's unearned pay into preparing for that eventuality rather than making it less likely by behaving better as a citizen of the world and cooperating and making friends with other nations instead of provoking them to further war. Thank you.
Thank you, especially for the nice setup at the end. Yeah, we haven't been attacked, which is wonderful. So we haven't been the person walking home tonight who gets attacked. But we are the fully capable person who can prevent other people from being attacked and who can come to their aid, whether it's to the Kuwaitis, whether it's the Bosnians, whether it's the people of France and England. I would encourage you to go over to World War II ceremonies in Europe. The people love us. I've lived in Europe. A pacifist is someone who has never been threatened, realistically. When you're threatened, you're willing to fight back. There's a great book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, written by Chris Hedges. He was a New York Times correspondent during the siege of Sarajevo. He was in Sarajevo. And just talking a few months ago, he said both these lines. He considered himself anti-war pacifist. He's seen too much war. He hates it. He says, war is always wrong. But boy, I was really proud of those Sarajevans. They were totally justified in fighting to stop extinction from the Bosnian Serbs who were attacking him. Well, then war's not always wrong. The Bosnian Serbs were wrong, but you just said how much you admired and how much you loved and how proud you were of the Bosnian Muslims fighting back. So it comes back to our same point. In war, there is always someone who's really bad, or maybe people who are really confused, but usually there's someone bad doing something they shouldn't, being a militarist. The person fighting back is justified. Suicide, that's a terrible thing. One thing I work for, if you look up for me, or I work on, is moral injury. I think we have to help soldiers make sense of encountering evil in war. And it seems to just jump off on you. But the problem of suicide is a much bigger problem than just our veterans. It seems to be a problem of meaning within our society. We should love our enemies. I don't think we train this way, but I think it is fully consistent to love someone and in certain circumstances, in order to protect others, to do violence to them. Let's say I had an alcoholic brother who was very violent, who was in and out of jail for years. And one time when he's really drunk, he's coming out and saying he's got a gun, he's going to get in a car, and he wants to go kill some person for whatever reason. And all his other brothers, knowing you can't reason with him when he's drunk and he's this angry, go up and have to fight him, beat him up, to stop him from going out on the road, killing someone else or killing himself. That was an act of love. If you just came up with it, it was an act of violence.
Two wars out of dozens and dozens of wars over the past decades cannot possibly justify keeping around the most disastrous, costly institution known to humanity, the worst thing we ever do to each other. We can talk about why those two particular wars were not necessary, were not last resorts, were not just causes, the propaganda to sell the war on Yugoslavia, the intentional, as I said, avoiding of agreement in a debate, but to justify this disastrous institution and all of the agreed upon unjust wars in recent decades with those two little wars is ridiculous. I heard, Pete, in an interview, you talking about soldiers killing people on Haifa Street in Baghdad, and they killed three insurgents, clearly bad people. What is a clearly bad person, I want to know? And how is it that you love them and characterize them based on not having met them, but having heard they were armed and in a street in Iraq, clearly bad people? And again, yet again, what good did killing all those people in all those streets in Iraq do for Iraq? Yes, we're supposed to ask each other questions. I'm not sure if my partner wants to do that.
Okay, you can ask me a question first, and then I'll think up.
Well, I've asked quite a few. I've asked what good has been done thus far for Iraq. I've asked how you can quantify which wars are the good ones and which wars are the bad ones.
Well, the good ones are the ones in which there is a value to defending human rights in the political communities. I mean, I know you've never been to Iraq, you haven't been to Afghanistan, you haven't been to Kuwait. I spent a lot of time there. I had the great luxury, I wasn't a trigger puller, I was a researcher. And so I went along with patrols day after day when their 2007 surge, when they're clearing pretty much every house in Baghdad and in the country looking for weapons. I would just sit and talk with the family, with the interpreters while soldiers were going through things. I found overwhelmingly the people wanted us there. They didn't trust our national police, which was all Shiite, who were executing Sunnis wherever they could find them. They didn't like the Sunni tribes and the Sons of Iraq, who were killing Shiites whenever they could. Maybe we made the mistake. I think Iraq was a strategic error. It was imprudent. If you're going to do a humanitarian invasion or a humanitarian intervention, you need to be set up and organized to do a humanitarian intervention.
Can I reply, or do you want to ask me a question? Or?
Yeah, I would ask a question. So the people of Taiwan, the people of South Korea, the people of all of Central Europe, these countries that are asking the United States to put forces there, asking us to help defend them, because they have a big neighbor who has territorial ambitions on them, do you think we should abandon them militarily and publicly announce that we would not come to their defense?
Well, when I was in Afghanistan, despite never having been in Afghanistan, saw a very different picture. And when I look at the world and talk with people around the world, as I do every day, I get a very different picture. When you poll the world, as I said in my opening remarks, you get a very different response. The U.S. not appreciated as the global cop, in fact, viewed as the greatest threat to peace in the world. The people of South Korea had a nonviolent revolution, an impeachment, an overthrow, a new government, because the old government would not stand up to the United States. And the new president is now finally showing signs of standing up to the United States. The people of South Korea do not want a war between the United States and North Korea. They're the ones who are going to die in it. What the CIA said before attacking Iraq was any weapons they have will only be used if they're attacked. What the Pacific Command of the U.S. military says now is that North Korea is no threat. It would be suicidal for them. There is absolutely no chance of North Korea starting this war. It is going to be the United States. And of course, Iran, the other demon haunting everyone, hasn't started a war literally in centuries. Do I think anybody wants a war? I think when you see the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations go and almost parrot word for word Colin Powell substituting the word Iran for Iraq, that's somebody wanting a war. I think when Mike Pence, as well as the president of Japan, and Mike Pence's wife seem to be the only three human beings in a giant stadium who cannot stand for a celebration of peace and unity and must sit on their rears glaring around at people wishing for hostilities, that's resistance to peace, if nothing else.
I'll do a final comment, because I think you try to create division where there's not. I have deep concerns. I hate the military-industrial complex. Right? We don't need to be doing that. I think we need to reassess our role around the world. I think every country that we have forces in should have a plebiscite, have a vote to say whether they want us or make them commit to that. All of those are fully consistent with the principle for people in the United States or anywhere in the world that every political community has the right to defend itself against external attack. And if you don't think that there's bad actors who conduct external attacks, then I'm not sure how all these wars are always happening all over the war.
Yeah. But if you let the people of Jeju Island have a vote, there goes the new base on Jeju Island. You let the people of Okinawa have a vote, there goes the... You let the people of Italy have a vote, there go the base. I mean, the protests,
well, let's see,
the resistance... What do you mean, let's see? Vicenza, Italy, where I used to live, they had a public vote. Do you want the base expanded several fold? Overwhelmingly, no. They threw out the government. They overthrew the national government of Italy over this issue. And what happened? They built the base anyway.
I guess I have to trust you. And the things I know about, I got some concerns, but we can open to questions.
I'm a honorably discharged member of the Air Force of the United States as a conscientious objector back around the time of the Vietnam War. I want to offer my questions to Pete. You may see my shirt here. It says, when Jesus says love our enemies, I think he meant don't kill them. In light of Jesus' teaching to love our enemies, how does any war make sense? That's my first question. And as a member of the Church of the Brethren, one of the historic peace churches, we have always taken the position that all war is sin. What's your response to that? And then thirdly, if I may, you said that a pacifist, and I'm a conscientious objector, so I guess you could say I'm a pacifist, is one who's never been threatened. I would ask you about Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela, who were threatened and who remained nonviolent.
And that's great. You could add Gandhi to that, right? Because they were trying to convince a wider population that did have strong values and care about what's right and wrong. So that's the third, your question. The first question about how can we love our neighbor and kill them. You don't go just...
Enemies and kill them.
Your enemies. Well, everyone's our neighbor, right, in that sense. I think a very healthy analogy for thinking about war is a doctor performing an amputation. Because if you just look at the action, that dude just went up and cut someone's leg off with a saw. It's violent, it's sad, it changes things forever bad, right? But in the larger context, the only choices they had at that point were to let the person die or to perform the amputation. So war happens in the realm of really bad choices, right? War happens when we all say we want peace, but someone's not allowing that to go on. It's sad, it's tragic. War isn't good. War isn't like helping people cross the street. War is saying is, we have an awful situation. What can we do to end the situation to reestablish peace and security? Sometimes you have to say, it's not the most loving thing to do to engage you, but it's the loving thing to protect all these people you're threatening. That's how.
I'm a scientist, physicist, and biologist. Why is there war? And why is it persistent? The point I would make from the perspective of human biology is that the low casualty rate of war, historically, is a indicator that war pays, that war has benefit. And the benefit is that the predator gets away with something. And the other side of that coin is that those who would be preyed upon have better organized themselves and get defensive. So you have the mechanism for generating war. So if the casualty rate in war were to be extreme, 50%, every time you go to war, you're going to suffer a 50% casualty rate. And you can also add to that the loss of treasure. There will be a 50% loss of national treasure. It wouldn't be done. But the fact that it's low makes it feasible.
Can I respond to this one? Because I also wanted to respond to your earlier.
Okay. Can I make one pithy comment and then you get the whole thing? As I say, the biggest thing we could do to cut down on unnecessary wars is make it that everyone who votes for war, the president and everyone else, their family members have to go fight on the front lines. Because if it's really worth it, then it should be worth it for your family and your lives too. Once that was the case with Leonidas, right, and some kind of leaders, and we have the opposite now, and that's a risk.
I think your comments, sir, are very helpful and useful and relevant. I think it's useful to point out that the casualty rate in Iraq was very significant in the recent wars for the Iraqi population, whereas the U.S. deaths in that war, like in most wars that take up 90% of the reported deaths in U.S. media, were, 3% or something of the deaths in that war. I just wanted to speak to this constant retreating to analogies, because, a good Samaritan, as an individual, is not relevant to the institution of war or the launching of war by governments or non-governmental groups. Even warmonger herself, Margaret Thatcher, said if the Good Samaritan had just had good intentions, nobody would remember him. He also had money. Well, he not only had money, he had a voice. He had a brain. This notion that if you see someone being attacked on a street, there's nothing you can do but shoot the attacker. That you can't say, for example, to take the analogy to the level of U.S. military spending, would you like $5 trillion to stop attacking that person? But for me to even engage in that discussion takes us away from the question of war, which has almost no relationship to doctors performing surgeries or people rescuing victims of mugging. If we're going to talk about war, let's talk about some wars.
There's one issue in particular that I'm really interested to hear more from you, especially from David, and that's on the issue of nonviolent resistance to evil in the world. I personally am skeptical that can always be effective. I think there are some cases where it may not be effective. I think, obviously the seminal example in history is the Jews of Germany and Eastern Europe in the World War II period under Hitler, and doing sort of the Gandhi-style nonviolent resistance may not have been effective in that case. But it sounds like your opinion is that it always can be effective, and I'm interested to hear more about specifically how you believe that can be the case in a situation like, for example, fighting back against Hitler nonviolently. Another point I want to make or question related to this is, what do you think about the idea of international institutions taking over the responsibility in the world for peacekeeping? What if we had a more robust United Nations, for example, or some kind of organization of that nature that would play the role of being sort of the defense mechanism of last resort in cases like genocide?
Nonviolent movements are not always effective. No one has ever claimed they are. What the facts have shown is that they have become over twice as likely to succeed as principally violent movements. I wish these plastic bottles of water around here were Evian, because I think it's relevant that Evian is a town in France where the Western the nations of the world met and considered where will we accept all the Jews that the Nazis want to expel. They didn't want to kill them for years. They wanted to expel them, which is it's insane. And the outcome was, as with numerous other conferences, right through the course of the war, we will not accept them. It, right through the course of the war, Churchill and the State Department were telling the peace activists who were demanding that the Jews be taken out, we can't be bothered. We couldn't do it. You know, we know a lot more about nonviolence now than people knew back then. So I think when you look at something like the people in Tunisia 7 years ago overthrowing a government with a nonviolent movement, many flaws, far from, perfect paradise in Tunisia, you wouldn't go back to them and say, hey, you really should try this other method that kills lots of people and is over twice as likely to fail. Just because they might have failed. Of course they might have failed.
Yeah, when I heard the question, is nonviolence always effective? Has there ever been a nonviolent movement that has expelled a foreign invader?
Well, you're not going to count the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe. You're not going to count the Baltics and their nonviolent movements that took apart the Soviet Union. If you're not going to count Morocco in Western Sahara, if you're not going to count Israel in parts of Palestine, if you're not going to count parts of Ukraine, in fact, in the current turmoil on both sides of the question, expelling armed invaders nonviolently from their cities. I mean, what are you going to count as a violent invasion?
Well, do you want to have a final word? Because I just had a final word.
Well,
you can have.
I would conclude that in large agreement that the power to destroy the earth with fire and fury at the drop of a button should not be entrusted to anyone, anybody. Nobody should have that. And if we did have a referendum, as was almost enacted in the 1930s before any war, we wouldn't have any wars. If we had democracy instead of wars to spread democracy, we wouldn't have wars.
Yeah, I'd love to believe that's true, except they're always popular when they start with a whole lot of support. What soldiers worry about is when you get us into silly wars, aren't committed as a nation to do it, and then we're stuck with fighting it when the popularity goes away.
Let's have a big round of applause.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Pete Kilner and David Swanson. Is war ever justifiable? They spoke at Radford University in Radford, Virginia. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Michael Parenti, Noam Chomsky, Michelle Alexander, Nancy McLean, and Nomi Prince. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of David Swanson and Pete Kilner, is war ever justifiable? Call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Edwin Starr, War.
To me. Oh!